And now, the art of Duane Eddy, the noise of twang, the sound of Peter Gunn.
Here's a fresh podcast from your radio pal, Peter B. Collins. This program is supported by great listeners, and today we'll mention just one, Annawell T. Rinaldi from Corvallis, Oregon. She just renewed her voluntary subscription by mail because she doesn't like to use PayPal after what they did to WikiLeaks and Allied Forces. And I could use a little extra help these days, so if you haven't ponied up and you're able to, think about it, okay? All the info's on my website, peterbcollins.com, on the right-hand side of the homepage where you can use PayPal. And if you prefer, you can send me a contribution directly at Box 100, Mill Valley, California, 94942. Today's podcast is another installment in the Boiling Frogs interview series, co-hosted with Sibel Edmonds. And this is an issue Sibel knows a lot about. Our guest today is Stephen Martin Cohn, the executive director of the National Whistleblower Center, the author of the new The Whistleblower's Handbook, and Sibel Edmonds' attorney. You're going to hear some powerful conversation about the status of whistleblower protections. They suck. And they're about to get worse. Steve Cohn has an invitation to activism for you in this conversation. He also has some of the sharpest and most focused critical comments about the case of Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks that I have heard to date. So be sure to share this podcast widely with friends and like-minded individuals. And thank you for listening. Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight is fixed. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows. But today, NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to the Boiling Frogs. With Sibel Edmonds, I'm Peter B. Collins. And today we welcome back a returning guest to the program. He's been in hot water before. Stephen Martin Cohn from the National Whistleblower Center, who has served as an attorney for Sibel Edmonds in her issues with the United States government over the years. And he's just published the Whistleblower's Handbook, subtitled A Step-by-Step Guide to Doing What's Right and Protecting Yourself. Stephen Cohn, welcome back to the Boiling Frogs.
Well, thank you so much, Peter and Sibel. It's an honor.
And I want to thank you for a great book about an issue that we both feel very strongly about. Whistleblowers come in all shapes and sizes. They blow the whistle on corporate wrongdoing, on government wrongdoing, and many of them have suffered a great deal as a result of their desire to be honest, ethical employees, and in the case of government workers, to honor commitments they've made security clearances and other agreements that were in force. And I'd like to start here with rule number 3 in your book, because Sibel and I have interviewed over a dozen whistleblowers from a variety of government departments, the CIA, the DEA, the FBI, the NSA, and the FAA, various organizations. And time and again, people say, I didn't intend to be a whistleblower. I was only doing my job. And that's the quote that you used to open the third chapter of your book. And I imagine that almost everyone who comes into your office to seek legal advice or representation, having been a whistleblower, has almost the same lament.
You know, you're 100% true. You know, they come in, and I am not a whistleblower. That's adamantly declaring that. I was only doing my job. And they're 100% right. You know, whistleblowers are doing their job. But the problem is their managers don't like it. The politicians they're exposing don't like it. No one likes to have their fraud and misconduct turned in. So you may think you're serving the public interest, but those above you, your management, will not. And what's critical here is the sooner an employee understands that they're going to be classified as a whistleblower, the better. Because most of the mistakes and cases happen during that what I call the yellow brick road phase, where you start blowing the whistle and you think you're going to get the medal, you think you're going to get the handshake, you think you're just doing the right thing. And by the time you realize that your management has turned on you, they're the ones setting traps. They're the ones who have been talking to in-house counsel on how to sabotage your career. And that's the heartbreaking part. I mean, if you only knew how many times in my office someone who's an absolute loyal, dedicated public servant tells me their story, and I can just see the mistakes that have been made, totally innocent. But I know the very high-paid corporate lawyers and the excellently skilled government lawyers who are paid a lot of money to fire whistleblowers. They know where those mistakes are. So the key is to really understand that you are a whistleblower as early as you can and work to defend against making those early errors.
And your book, really, we're going to get into some of the details here in a moment. It is a guidebook. It offers legal tips and anecdotes about people's cases. And if you're in a position where you think you want to report wrongdoing at the place where you work, whether it's government, corporate, or somewhere in between, a nonprofit, you really should pick this up first, because for the price of a paperback, $17, you can save yourself legal expenses down the road and maybe losing your job. And Steve, just to give you an example, just 3 hours ago, I was driving in my car listening to a local radio station that has a one-hour daily show with a lawyer. And a woman called in who said that in her workplace, she reported to the HR department that one of her supervisors was violating the nepotism rule at the company. She had hired her husband. And the complainant didn't think she was a whistleblower. She just thought that this was something that, you know, the higher-ups should know about. And within 10 days, she was hazed by her immediate supervisor and then fired by the human resources director. And she was still kind of shaking her head, not sure what had happened to her. And so your book, I think, is vital to people who see wrongdoing, have the correct response in trying to do something about it, but they really need to protect themselves. And that's where this book is important. Take a moment here to talk about whistleblower cases that went sideways, where a well-intentioned and sincere individual got totally screwed for trying to do the right thing.
Well, let me give you an example. And it's the rule that says beware of hotlines. So there was an employee at an atomic energy plant in Texas, and he saw safety problems. And hanging up all in the plant were signs that say, if you see a problem, report to Safe Team, which was a company-run hotline.
Mm-hmm.
So he sees major safety issues. He calls the hotline. He reports it. He gets fired. So he files his case with the Department of Labor. Secretary of Labor, under President Reagan and Bush, endorse him. They say, oh, obviously, if you go report to a hotline, the company tells you to do it, you're protected. Well, guess what? When it went to the appeals court, they said, no way. The statute says report to the government. So even though the company told you to go to the hotline, you lose your case. So this guy won his case. He had won reinstatement, back pay, only to have it all tossed out and his entire career in atomic energy destroyed because he did what the poster said and what served the public interest. Now, had he researched the law at the time, he would have known that there were some courts that had this terrible ruling, and in Texas was one of them. So it's the tiniest little mistake, like who do you report the misconduct to? And I can tell you right now, reporting it to HR, like that woman did on the phone, mm-hmm. that's not a good place to go. And half the states is not even protected activity. And why would HR want to help you? So I would never recommend someone going to HR.
Steve, in the introduction to the book, you cite a sinister anti-corporate group called PricewaterhouseCoopers, and they conducted, I'm being cynical, they conducted a study, and they discovered that in exposing corporate fraud, that the most effective technique was not the law, was not the local district attorney, or, say, for example, the Securities and Exchange Commission, but what they refer to as tipsters and what you call whistleblowers are the single most effective source of information in both detecting and rooting out corporate criminal activity.
Yeah, and that's exactly true. And that's really why things are changing now. They are getting better for some whistleblowers. Some of the laws are getting stronger. And it's because people have conducted scientifically valid surveys. PricewaterhouseCoopers was one of the first, and they interviewed 5,200 corporate CEOs. But since then, two other organizations, the Association of Certified Fraud Auditors and the Ethics Resource Center, conducted polling and interviewing. Every single one of these groups came up pretty much with the exact same statistic. Employee whistleblowers are the number one source of all fraud detection, period. And in government, the private sector, in hospitals, educational institutions, etc. And they're probably about 15 times more effective than the police. And because most organizations don't have good whistleblower protections, the conclusion is the value of the whistleblower is understated. So now you have the problem. If you want to detect fraud, you have to protect whistleblowers. And that's it, bottom line. And as all of these organizations that have studied it have concluded, fraud and misconduct are designed to be hidden. They're designed to be secret. So you need the insider to see it and report it.
Now, did the PricewaterhouseCoopers survey also explore the attitudes of these CEOs about whether they really wanted to root out the fraud and corruption? Because I can understand that a CEO wants to stop the loss of inventory that where truckloads of materials are stolen, sent to the wrong location. But most CEOs aren't too interested in explorations of their grants of stock options, the dates on which the options were marked, and activities like that. And so We have to get into the other mindset here, which is how much do corporate CEOs really want their business to be run in a completely honest way?
And that's the rub. On the one hand, these organizations are recommending strong whistleblower protections. But on the other hand, they don't want them. They're fighting them. They're resisting them. It's a conflict. The way many of the companies have resolved it is by putting their Office of General Counsel, the attorney, in charge of their internal whistleblower programs. It's a conflict of interest. That attorney does not represent the shareholders or the public interest. They generally represent the board of directors and the top-ranking officials. So what occurs is if the whistleblowing is the type of disclosure that the company finds embarrassing and doesn't want to go public, often the general counsel will ensure that the whistleblower is stifled. And that's a complete conflict. And it's interesting because within corporate culture today, there's a conflict. I talk to compliance officials. Many of them understand that the general counsel should not have a role within the company on controlling whistleblower disclosures. Unfortunately, the vast majority of companies leave it up to general counsel.
Steve, you're the attorney here. Can you give us a quick sketch of the concept of Qui or Quitam? It's Q-U-I-T-A-M, and this is a Latin term that refers to enforcement of laws in the name of the king. Give us the history and how that influences the current laws that are on the books.
Well, the quitam concept is now the hottest item in whistleblowing. What it does is if the whistleblower is correct and proven right, they get a financial reward. And it comes from the old days when citizens were empowered to enforce the laws in the name of the king, that's where quitam comes, and would get a reward if they enforced it correctly. It's real grassroots citizen empowerment. The way it works now is, so if the whistleblower turns in a fraud, and the biggest laws under the False Claims Act, which covers government contracting, and if they find that fraud did occur, the government collects the money, the whistleblower gets between 15 and 30% of what the government collects. Now, this is what has happened. If you look at those studies from PricewaterhouseCoopers and the Association of Certified Fraud Auditors that show that employees detect fraud, and you combine it with a monetary reward for turning it in, the result is the world's strongest anti-fraud law, period. When there was no quitam in government contracting, none, which was 1987, the United States collected about $80 million a year in civil enforcement for people who robbed from the government, they sued them and got the money back. In 2010, under the quitam, that rose to $3 billion in recoveries. And 80% of those recoveries were from whistleblowers. In other words, the whistleblowers are bringing back to the taxpayer billions. And here's the amazing thing. If you look at the federal government and you line up all the inspector generals, all of the contract administrators, this army of police, yet the whistleblowers are detecting 80% of the fraud. That's actually winning the cases and recovering it, just what PricewaterhouseCoopers predicted would happen. And what's incredible, and this has been a real silent revolution, but I've added up the numbers from 1987 to today. How much have whistleblowers turned in and saved the taxpayers? It's in the billions and billions of dollars. So much so that whistleblowers have actually obtained $2.7 billion in rewards. That means the federal government has written out checks to whistleblowers, not for back pay or retaliation, for a reward. It's just so fundamentally radical in a sense of what people think of whistleblowers. It works. It's the most effective mechanism of fraud detection. And because it has worked, the federal government has now expanded these quitam laws beyond government contracting to now securities fraud, commodities fraud, and tax fraud. And state governments are picking it up. 25 states have now enacted whistleblower reward laws. So it's a total change, but predicated on the indisputable fact that whistleblowers are the best source of fraud enforcement and detection, and that retaliation exists, and that the only way to encourage or induce a whistleblower to come out and risk their career is to put some form of reward out there.
Steve, you and I talked about this 2 weeks ago, and the comparison is absolutely mind-boggling, because you have corporate whistleblowers, and they're encouraged to come forward and bring these cases where government goes after the corporations engaged in fraud, and the whistleblowers get awarded. So in this case, $2.7 billion just in the last 20 years or so. Yet, What we have, on the other hand, is the government whistleblowers, because when government whistleblowers, they blow the whistle, there's no one to go to, because government is the absolute power. I mean, it's almost like tyrannical, because they blow the whistle, and the government goes after the whistleblowers, and there is no layer above to go to.
Well, Sibel, you're 100% correct, and it's a real tragedy here. 25, 30, 40 years ago, government workers were viewed as having better whistleblower rights than the private sector because of the First Amendment and some early whistleblower laws. Today, it's the exact opposite, especially federal employees. They have pretty much the least amount of rights of any class of worker. So what's incredible here, there's no qui tams for them. If a federal employee saves the taxpayers $1 billion, they get nothing. What they will get, pretty much, is being fired. That's what the statistics show. And it doesn't matter if 15 years later it's proven they were some form of hero. They're out on the street. Now, so there have been no reforms for federal employees, no rewards. And what's incredible is there's no incentive for the federal agencies to police themselves. The big change going on in corporate America is that these companies are seeing these reward laws. They're seeing that whistleblowers are getting millions and millions of dollars. So what are the companies doing? They're cleaning up their act. They're setting up enforcement. They're setting up compliance. They're trying to set up an internal structure so they don't get whacked. You don't see that in the federal government. It's the exact opposite. The level of retaliation I have seen, not just in national security agencies, which are the worst, because on top of all of the restrictions, they threaten employees with, you know, security clearance withdrawals, etc., but even in agencies like the Food and Drug Administration that deal with health and safety, these employees are getting hammered. So they're in a world where there's, forget rewards, it's straight-up retaliation, no court access, and no accountability. So federal employees, and it's in the book, are in one of some of the toughest position right now. State and local employees come second.
So, Steve, we talk about the corporate whistleblowers, and we talk about the government whistleblowers. We also have in the middle these hybrid companies with these really strong contracts with the government in national security areas, let's say companies like Blackwater, et cetera, that, you know, even their employees have to obtain security clearance. And since they're in the middle and they get to see also fraud and maybe abuses from both sides, the corporation side, the corporate side, but also from the government side, how does things apply to those people when they have to have security clearance? You know, the private contractors, just in D.C. alone. I mean, you're looking at millions of people working for private companies who are required to have security clearance. And even though their work is, full-time work is with their, you know, corporate, then the corporate is having contract work, and that's the job that the employee is doing. So how does that affect the situation when the whistleblower is in this in-between kind of situation?
Well, a fantastic question, because people generally assume that national security whistleblowers lack rights, and it's generally true. However, if you have a government contract, even if it's a quote-unquote black contract, top secret, you are protected under the False Claims Act. So government contractors, employees, on top secret projects, are protected under False Claims Act. What does that mean? It means you are entitled to a reward. There's also a very strong anti-retaliation provision. You can go to court. You can get a jury trial. And you can get double back pay. Most people don't know this. Most people think that if you're working on one of these top secret classified contracts, you have no rights. You do have rights. Even if they make you sign agreements, non-disclosure agreements, confidentiality agreements, guess what? You have rights. Because under the False Claims Act, there's a very unique reporting provision that lets you go to the Attorney General. And the Attorney General is, for the most part, cleared to obtain the information. even if they're not, we've developed ways that people can blow the whistle on it by essentially pooling the information at work. Like, I've had, you know, a person can take a CD-ROM of all the good stuff that even may be classified, but they don't walk out the door. They stash it. They hide it at the job site. Then you go and blow the whistle, and you tell the attorney general, you say, you want all my information, go to, you know, the fifth floor, third desk on the top right-hand, you know, file drawer, you'll find my CD-ROM. Then they have to get cleared for access to the information, and they go in and get it. There's ways around it, but the False Claims Act has not been aggressively used on confidential black contracts, and it can be. In looking at, say, Blackwater and all their misconduct, they clearly should have been sued under False Claims Act left and right.
Steve, in the book, you point out that just last year, the Dodd-Frank Act enhanced protections for corporate whistleblowers on the heels of Enron, WorldCom, and the Wall Street meltdown. And that's a good thing. But we see that promises by the current president to protect national security whistleblowers have not only gone unfulfilled, it appears that efforts at so-called reform would actually roll back existing protections for certain types of national security whistleblowers. Now, I'd like to offer three examples and ask you to comment on the differences and, you know, what courses of action might remain. Number one, Mark Klein, who has been on our program, is the Bay Area former technician for AT&T, who exposed the massive diversion of signals, telephonic and email signals, at the AT&T office here in San Francisco, where the NSA installed this big fiber optic splitter and basically copied every transmission that was going through there. Mark Klein did not have a security clearance, so when he exposed this information, while nobody really did much with it, particularly news organizations and Senator Feinstein on the Intelligence Committee, he didn't have any real vulnerabilities because he had never signed a government clearance agreement. Contrast his case with Bunatine Greenhouse, who is or was a client of yours, and she was an inspector at the Pentagon. I think more accurately, she was a contract buyer, and she blew the whistle on no-bid contracts that were awarded to Kellogg Brown & Root, KBR, and Halliburton as we were occupying the nation of Iraq. And I don't know the status of her case, but I don't believe that she's gotten satisfaction. And then there's the case of my co-host here, Sabelle Edmonds, who was basically promised by two United States senators, Leahy and Grassley, that she would be invited to testify, and also Congressman Waxman when he headed the Oversight Committee in the House. All of them committed to her that they were going to hear her story and that they would protect her. Yet they didn't, and they didn't. So if you could use those three cases to illustrate the current state of protections for national security whistleblowers, I want to hear.
Okay. And just so you know, is we still do represent Bunny. We're fighting hard for her in federal court, and she did blow the whistle on the illegal no-bid contracts to Halliburton.
Mm-hmm.
Federal employee was in charge of one of the highest-ranking contracting officers at Army Corps, so she didn't have the protections of the False Claims Act, although she was blowing the whistle on contract fraud. But here's what's going on all three cases. National security employees were excluded by statute from the Whistleblower Protection Act that covers other employees. What does this mean? Well, let's just go straight back to it. If employees are the number one source of fraud and misconduct detection, which they are, scientifically proven, and if in the area of national security, you not only exclude them from coverage, so who's going to blow the whistle, but you hammer them like they did with Sabelle when they did state secrets, which is an implicit threat of prosecuting you under the Espionage Act once they declare the state secret, like they did with Bunny when they stripped her her position, sending a message to every other contracting officer to shut up. Mr. Klein finds himself in a similar boat. So what are they doing? They're sending a message that you can't blow the whistle on national security issues. The result, a war in Iraq with hundreds of thousands of dead people on phony grounds. All of the evidence about the 9/11 attacks, about how much we should have known or did know, incredible evidence that we could have prevented those attacks. Look at the devastating impact on human life, on world affairs, when fraud and misconduct festers in a major segment of our government. And that's what we're going to be living with between now and who knows when someone finally wakes up. By excluding whistleblower protection on the national security establishment, you are cutting off the single most important source of information. Congress has recognized that whistleblowers are the most important source in all these other laws. But in their own backyard, in their own black contracts, in their own little deals, employees are left with nothing. And I want to say, when I say nothing, Sabell was threatened. But now they are prosecuting people under Espionage Act. They are indicting whistleblowers. And it's real. It's a really scary mess. And in fact, instead of strengthening, and this is a tragedy, Obama did run under the platform of giving all federal employees, including national security, real whistleblower rights. Instead of that, we're now looking at this bill that has gone through the Senate Intelligence Committee, Senator Feinstein, S-719, that would permit the head of every intelligence-related agency to strip whistleblowers of their pensions. Even after they leave government work, their life earnings, their pensions, without a court order, unilaterally. And they say, oh, this is just intelligence. But look at the agencies covered. Yes, the NSA, the CIA, the FBI, they're not happy there. Justice Department, Energy Department, Treasury Department, Defense Department, Army, Navy, Homeland Security. They have now have a bill to strip whistleblowers of pensions. My question is just simple. Who would ever blow the whistle on a national security matter if you could be fired, lose your pension, and potentially indicted? They're ensuring that the worst frauds and misconduct will go undetected. And this is a real, real problem for us.
But Steve, the very groups of people you just described enjoy the Merit Service Protection Board, which I wouldn't even have known about if it weren't for talking with you and Sabell.
Yes. Well, first off, this pension stripping, you don't even get to the Merit Systems Board.
Yeah.
It's done by the head of the agency. And then the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, can be your judge. I mean, so it's a joke. But the Merit Systems Protection Board, when I said earlier that federal employees have the weakest protection of pretty much in the United States, the Merit Systems Protection Board is the board that's supposed to protect federal employee whistleblowers. But it's a hoax. Here's why. There's three members of the board, presidentially appointed, two from the party in power, one from the party out of power. That means that this board is always controlled by the person who sits in the White House. And the person who sits in the White House always has an interest in keeping scandals covered up. They have no interest in a whistleblower embarrassing their administration. So, and there's no qualifications for these board members. They don't have to be a judge. So they sit in the board and decide the whistleblower cases, but by the nature of the procedures, they're political. And what I've learned in my 28 years of representing whistleblowers, if a whistleblower case becomes political, the whistleblower always loses. Whistleblowers need real, independent courts to protect them. And that has never happened with the Merit Systems Board.
So, Steve, let's go back to this upcoming bill, because it's really important. Then we just think, okay, things cannot get any worse. Actually, they do. And who actually came up with this really awful, unjust, disastrous idea?
Yeah.
And what's the status of it, and what we can do? Because, as you know, I mean, I don't work with any other so-called whistleblower organizations. The only ones I work with are people from National Whistleblower Center, because nobody else, even the ones who say they are whistleblower organizations, they don't stand up for national security whistleblowers. Usually national security whistleblowers become the compromise coin to say, okay, you guys go ahead and screw national security whistleblowers, but let us get this and this and this. So we've been working with you, and I know this bill is coming up. Tell us who came up with it, what's the status, and what we can do, and what people can do about this.
Okay. The bill, S-719, is a disastrous bill, one of the worst anti-whistleblower bills I've ever seen, because it strikes at people's pensions, which is really, you've worked for 25, 30 years in the federal government, that's how you will survive. It's one thing getting fired, it's another thing not having a pension. It's just mind-boggling. It came out of the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is chaired by Senator Feinstein from California, and she voted in favor of it. A couple senators opposed it, including Senator Wyden from Oregon. We have an action alert on this, which is where you can come to our webpage, which is whistleblowers.org, and very simply sign up and send an email to your senators telling them to oppose this bill. It's really interesting because Senator Wyden has threatened to put a hold on the entire bill if this provision is not taken out. But Senator Coburn, a very conservative Republican from Oklahoma, has threatened to put a hold on the entire bill if it's not in. And what we've been told is it's essentially whoever makes the most noise wins. That if we can get enough noise that Wyden holds his position and refuses to lift his hold on the bill, we will win and it will be taken out. On the other hand, if there's not a large public outcry, Senator Coburn will win. It's as simple as that. We were told that Feinstein from California, the chair, wants the bill in its entirety to pass, and she's willing to get rid of this pension provision to get the whole bill through, but only if there's real widespread public support for Wyden and for cutting out this notorious anti-whistleblower provision.
What motivates Feinstein, Steve? I mean, what is this woman's agenda? Obviously, it's a good marketing PR job by the federal government. Is it the White House? Is it the Justice Department? Who has lobbied so hard with Feinstein for this woman to come and try to push this bill? I mean, what is motivating this woman?
I think what it is, you know, secrecy breeds corruption. I think in these contracts, and it's billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars in government contracts that pay the whole national security establishment, and these contracts go into senators' states. There's massive defense contracting in California, local congressmen's districts. And because blowing the whistle on these expenditures is so difficult, and that the federal employees who are supposed to monitor these programs have no rights, it breeds corruption. And you know what? Corruption breeds corruption. They do not want any whistleblowers, period. So someone figured out the best way to ensure they'll never be a whistleblower. Strip them of their pensions.
Well,
and then give it to the DNI to do, or just to the head. I mean, Sabelle, could you imagine if you worked in the FBI for 30 years, you were dependent upon it for your, you know, everything, and you're reaching retirement age, and the director of the FBI, without any court ruling, could simply call you in and say, Sabelle, I've decided to take away your pension. Tough luck. I mean, imagine the chilling effect.
Well, and let me offer a little background on Senator Feinstein. I've known her for more than 30 years, since she was mayor of San Francisco. And she was always an authoritarian on law and order issues, very much out of step with the kind of progressive laissez-faire attitude in San Francisco. And I'll also point out that Louis Freeh, the current head of the FBI, was a U.S. attorney here in San Francisco, and it was Dianne Feinstein who promoted his promotion, his candidacy for FBI director. So
Mueller, that's correct.
Mueller, I'm sorry, thank you.
And Mueller despises whistleblowers. He's had one of the worst regimes against whistleblowers ever at the FBI. In fact, we were representing whistleblowers under Louis Freeh, and we thought things were bad. When Mueller came in, it was a nightmare. Mueller's the one who had him pull the state secrets on Sabell, completely disingenuous, no grounds whatsoever. Mueller has been viciously anti-whistleblower. And we've suspected, to be honest, that his lobbying has been behind a lot of the very bad provisions that they're trying to insert into law on national security. In fact, we've been told by people on the Hill that the FBI has an aggressive and sophisticated lobbying machine.
And just one other quick story about Feinstein. We mentioned Mark Klein, who exposed the wiretapping operation here in San Francisco. He went to Senator Feinstein and actually was directed to one of her staff members, who carefully collected all the information that Mark Klein had, and instead of holding a hearing or giving, you know, any kind of a procedure where Klein could effectively offer this information, she took it to the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence.
Yeah, and that's consistent with our, we have never recommended a whistleblower to go to the Senate Intelligence Committee, ever. And the people we work with on Congress who know Congress laugh at the notion of a whistleblower going to the Senate Intelligence Committee. It would be like the worst place you could go.
Yeah.
It's just a committee that in all of its years in existence has never helped a national security whistleblower. And the stories like Mr. Klein's are rampant. They just turn them in. They'll give up your identity back to the agency.
Yeah. Now, Steve, currently many people are aware of Bradley Manning, a private in the Army who has been transferred from Quantico to Leavenworth. He is accused of being the source of the WikiLeaks documents of secret and foreign-only intelligence that have been partially distributed by the WikiLeaks organization through participating news outlets. And recently at a fundraiser here in San Francisco that got some media play, a group infiltrated, they paid money to attend this breakfast, $5,000 a head, and then they sang a song. They interrupted the president and sang a song about Bradley Manning. That got some attention. There's a battle between the White House and the San Francisco newspaper that posted that video because they're accused of breaking the ground rules established by the White House. But more importantly, at the end of that event, one of the attendees was on videotape questioning the president about Bradley Manning. And the president made a number of assertions. One, flatly, that Manning broke the law, which is an outrageous, prejudicial statement from the commander-in-chief, who ultimately is the commander of those who will preside over a court-martial for Mr. Manning. Secondly, he misstated that when asked about the difference between Bradley Manning and Daniel Ellsberg in the Pentagon Papers, he narrowly was true in saying, well, there was a difference in the classification, but he was wrong in that the Pentagon Papers included top-secret information, and nothing that Bradley Manning is accused of leaking rises above the level of secret. And so this is the president who claims the most transparent administration in history, yet particularly in the WikiLeaks case, where we have material that is embarrassing but does not appear to be sensitive in terms of compromising our national security or really critical secrets. And yet the president seems comfortable in rationalizing a treatment for Bradley Manning that is roughly equivalent to what we gave to top terror suspects.
Yeah, I will say that the treatment of Manning has been a constitutional disgrace. It's like somehow you can suspend the Constitution when the president ushers the magic words national security. Not true. If you read the Constitution, it's not true. In fact, the Constitution put all types of checks against the military authority of the president, consciously. And if you go to the legislative history, they were very afraid that the executive would use their military powers in a way to suppress liberty, and they put restrictions on it. Bradley Manning is innocent until proven guilty, but no one in the executive is willing to admit that. He's being subjected to torture. There's rules against cruel and unusual punishment in the Constitution. He has been denied bail. That the right to bail is in the Constitution. And there's not a thread of evidence that if he was given bail, he's a flight risk. They're just flagrantly denying his constitutional rights, I believe torturing him in an attempt to somehow break him down. The treatment of him as an individual American citizen is a disgrace. Now let's go look at what he's accused of doing. But again, the First Amendment applies. The First Amendment gives Americans the right to disclose information about government misconduct. If the United States thinks he did something wrong, there's a mechanism, and they should be weighing each document and conducting what's known as a balancing test. Public's right to know versus whatever harm to national security the release may cause. I believe that question should be given to a jury. The government just can't stamp secret on every document and get away with it. That's censorship. That's a dictatorship. If the president can just declare things secret, misconduct is hidden. The voters cannot learn about critical facts necessary to exercise the franchise. How do you vote for one candidate or another if the president or the government can declare secret their crimes and misdemeanors? That's why the Constitution applies. And what is so heartbreaking is that there's such, a willingness of people to look at fundamental constitutional rights and just ignore them. And that's wrong, and it's just dumbfounding to me that there's not an uproar saying, hold it right there. He's an American. He has rights. And those rights are applied. And guess what? The founding fathers put it in the Constitution, not because they were afraid that Britney Spears would be censored or that American Idol would be taken off the air. They explicitly did it because they knew that unpopular people who do things that challenge the status quo are at risk, and therefore they enshrined in our Constitution certain fundamental rights. And it's the unpopular people that those rights were designed for. It's for Bradley Manning. No one had to be afraid that if Donald Trump got caught speeding, he would be denied bail. It's just never going to happen. But for Bradley Manning, who's been found guilty of nothing,
right,
to be held in solitary, in isolation, and denied his right to bail. And the reason why right to bail is so critical is because it's well known that it's one of the most important mechanisms to enable someone to conduct a defense and be found not guilty at the end of the day. If you're denied bail, it's so hard to put together a defense. And then the prejudicial statements of the president and others. How would any court-martial panel have the guts to find him not guilty? So it's essentially suppression of whistleblowing on steroids.
And Steve, does Bradley Manning's status as a member of the military or as someone who agreed to the terms of a security clearance at the secret level, does that compromise his rights in this process in any way?
As I say, even if you have a security clearance, the way the Supreme Court resolved the constitutional issue of freedom of speech is a document-by-document review and a balancing test as to whether that document should be released or not and whether it's properly classified. That actually can be done by a district court judge. The government just doesn't have the ultimate power to say this is classified and this isn't. And Mr. Manning, yes, he went, and he went to an extreme. But the fact that he went to an extreme does not mean he lost his rights. The government still must adhere to certain fundamental principles in our Constitution, period. And I think it's up to – it's just like the right when the Nazis marched in Stokey. Of course I despise the Nazis, and my father fought them, and I'm Jewish. But, you know, they had a right to march because they're the despicable group that if you take their right away, everyone will lose it. Or with that recent Supreme Court case where those people were picketing funerals.
The Phelps, yeah, Fred yeah. Phelps and his
okay,
family.
Okay, so if you're going to give it to the Nazis in Stokey, if you're going to give it to that weird religious sect who wanted to demonstrate against military funerals, guess what? Whistleblowers have rights too. But the difference between a whistleblower and a crackpot is, okay, give the crackpot rights, it really doesn't impact the power relations. But the whistleblowers have the information on fraud, abuse, and misconduct. The government has extremely specific reasons for wanting to suppress that speech. So they can pretend, oh, we have democracy in America, a Nazi can burn a cross. Well, that's just great, and I agree. But that same principle has to apply to the whistleblower. But the reason they don't like that is because the whistleblower may know about innocent people being murdered, about journalists being shot, about torture, and they don't want that coming out.
Let's provide your website again. It's for National Whistleblower Centers. It's whistleblowers.org. And Steve, we are not 501c3. Boiling Frogs Post is publication, online publication. And what I really want to do is we have quite a good following and get our people in California with Feinstein. And also, you said Coburn in Oklahoma?
Yes. Coburn in Oklahoma is critical.
And who else?
Feinstein in California is the most important. She's the chair. And then every U.S. senator in every state. Because what's happened is it's gone from the committee where it was voted and approved by Feinstein in a majority, and now it's going to the floor of the Senate. So every senator can weigh in against this bill now.
We're not going to let them do it quietly. We're going to make noise, okay? And Peter, I'm counting on you. You're in California. I'll put you on Feinstein. And I'm going to prepare some posts, and when we get ready to publish, post this interview right before that or after, we'll have more instructions and more details on our upcoming action alerts on this bill. And let's at least make it really difficult for them, if not impossible.
Yeah, that's extremely important. And we will have a very simple-to-use action alert on whistleblowerswithans.org. What I want to say about the bill, what makes it so insidious, you know, an Ellsberg or Bradley Manning, these things come around like once every 30 or 40 years. It's not typical. It's not typical of whistleblowing. It's not typical of the way employees do it. I'm not putting a value judgment on it. I'm saying it's an outlier. I will tell you this. I have never represented a national security whistleblower who was not concerned about their pension. I have never represented a federal employee who is not concerned about whether if they blow the whistle, they will lose their pension.
Absolutely.
They're willing to lose their job. They figure maybe they'll get a new one, but not the pension. They
Absolutely.
Work 20 or 30 years.
Our organization has more than 150 whistleblowers, and if you look at the average years of experience for these patriotic people, you're looking at 22 years.
Yes.
I did this stat. These people have invested 20-plus years in these organizations. Their entire livelihood depends on it. And as you said, you're absolutely right. They don't mind losing their jobs, but their pension is a different story.
Absolutely, and it comes up over and over again. And you're also correct, Sibel, that the typical whistleblower has been in over 20-plus years. And they've given their best years as a worker. So they need that pension. And whoever came up with this knows that. They knew how to hit the whistleblower under the belt, how to really create fear. And that's what's so insidious about that. and you sit back and say, my God, these people are really staying up night trying to figure out devious ways to make sure no one will ever blow the whistle. And this is about as devious as I've ever seen.
It's tyrannical. I mean, can you feel the water boiling, Peter?
Indeed. Now, Steve, two observations about the book. One is, when I got it, I was shocked to open it up and find that there's no evidence of anything being redacted here. You didn't submit this for pre-publication clearance, did you?
Absolutely not. And I'll tell you, I represent whistleblowers the last 28 years. I've represented many people in national security, and agencies have asked or encouraged, oh, why don't you get a clearance so you can better represent people? And I've just snickered. I will never get a clearance ever. I will never let the government control my access to information or my ability to represent a client ever. If you go in for one of those clearances, you're essentially making a deal. I understand that many of my clients have to do that. That's their livelihood. I'm an independent lawyer. I exercise independent judgment. I will never, ever let the government get in the way of my independent judgment on behalf of a client, period.
And finally, Steve, I wanted to ask you to explain a little bit about the functionality of the book, because this is not just a narrative book about past whistleblowers and, you know, isn't it sad the way many of them got screwed? It is a handbook for people who are considering blowing the whistle on an employer, whether it's a private, government, or nonprofit. And you've laid out here in great detail information on state laws regarding the False Claims Act, and also by category, military whistleblower protection, national security, nuclear safety, occupational health. And so tell us a little bit, if you would, a kind of user guide to the handbook so people can understand just how useful it can be.
Okay. You know, I've represented whistleblowers for 28 years. That's all I've done. And the book is almost like a dialogue, as a whistleblower would come and sit in my office. And there are a lot of stories in it, because I would tell a story about how an employee either won or lost a case, you know, using certain tactics or making certain mistakes. And it's 21 rules. It takes you from the very beginning just trying to figure out what type of law protects you, how to make a disclosure, all the way to how to maximize the amount of money you make. Because at the end of the day, if a whistleblower puts their career on the line, they deserve compensation. So it takes you all the way through the process, questions like, should you tape? Should you remove documents from work? How do you qualify for a reward? All the way through, and there are checklists at the end. It's written for any American to understand. It is not a book for lawyers, although a lot of lawyers are buying it. It's really a book for any American and who may see misconduct at work and want to know what to do with it. And it's 21 rules.
I wish I had it before I blew the whistle. I think I took many, many, many wrong steps, and I had no idea about the rules. I had no idea about the whistleblowing, period. I wish I had this book.
Yeah, and Sibel, it's interesting you say that, because you were in a very similar position to that person, Goldstein, at the nuclear power plant. You went to management within the FBI. Well, who wouldn't think that's where you should go? But under the FBI whistleblower law, as weird as it sounds, going to your manager is not protected. So you're 100% correct. But on the other hand, the inspector general did find that you were retaliated against. You had a major victory there. And the state secrets privilege that was pulled by Ashcroft, Attorney General Ashcroft, I viewed again as an underhanded move. It was, in my view, just as a lawyer, it was essentially cheating to win. The FBI knew they were going to lose that case, so they invoked state secrets to win it. It's rarely done. They were definitely afraid of you. And they invoke that privilege. It's kind of like this pension thing. It's underhanded. It's they know that if they do it, they will shut people up. And it's terrible. But the book itself lays out the 21 rules that are really applicable to every American. And I think, you know, we can be negative on a lot about whistleblowing and the rules and the laws, but I do like to end on an upbeat note. Rule 21 is never forget whistleblowing works. And it documents how successful whistleblowing has been for public health and safety, for fraud detection. And it explains how by using the fact that whistleblowing has been so successful is really the best way, at the end of the day, to try to win a whistleblower case. And people do win them, and people have collected rewards, although it's a struggle.
Stephen Martin Cohn is Executive Director of the National Whistleblower Center. They're on the web at whistleblowers.org. And the new book is The Whistleblower's Handbook, a step-by-step guide to doing what's right and protecting yourself. Steve Cohn, thanks for joining us again today on The Boiling Frogs.
Thank you.
Joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.